Maggie's reading a bedtime story to her daughter. And the handsome prince tried the glass slipper on Cinderella's foot, and it fitted. Now guess what happened next? They lived happily ever after, did they, Mummy? No, they got married. Many relationships go through four phases when the glow will either go or grow. Enchantment, disenchantment, drifting, and driving. Let's look at these four potential phases. Number one, enchantment. Maggie and Egbert have fallen in love and fallen out of circulation to some degree. Their communication is filled with reflections of their leisure interest, our song, our cafe, our beach. Maggie and Egbert's communication is often made in subtle symbolic expressions. Time passes. Maggie and Egbert are married now, and although their attention is commanded by the daily practicalities of life, their communication still revolves around social and leisure interests, friends, parties, gardening together, shopping together, playing sport together. They are both working and earning. Time passes. Maggie is pregnant now, and she leaves her job to become totally absorbed in her new baby. Egbert channels his energy into his career. Less of life is we and our, and the only common ground is essentially practical matters. For Maggie and Egbert, the language of companions has become traded off to a great degree by the language of business partners. Unless Maggie and Egbert make a conscious effort to work on their communicating, they will slowly drift apart for the next 20 years or so, until the last child leaving home creates the dreaded empty nest. Phase 2, disenchantment. When Maggie and Egbert are at home, face-to-face talk has become mask-to-mask talk. Warm talk has become small talk. And the nod and hug has become the ignore and shrug. At work, Maggie or Egbert may find a heart-to-heart rapport with an attractive colleague of the opposite sex who seems to support and understand interests and needs. Look out, Maggie or Egbert. Emotional entanglement lurks in the shadows. Frequently at the weekend and often in the evenings, Maggie and Egbert have what I call a communi-clash. How come you never buy me chocolates or flowers anymore? Why have you changed? Or maybe, you're not the person I married. Chances are that neither Egbert nor Maggie have altered much. It's just that during these enchantment days, each either glamorized or ignored the other's faults and foibles. Tonight, Maggie is clicking away with her needles, knitting. Egbert, absorbed in his reading, and the silence is ungolden. One is thinking, I love you so much I don't need to talk. And yet the other is thinking, you must be angry with me or you would talk to me. Maggie is concluding her bedtime story to Florence and Fred. And the handsome prince tried the glass slipper on Cinderella's foot, and it fitted. Guess what happened next, huh? They lived happily ever after, did they, Mummy? No, they got married. Marriage, my child, is an institution, and who wants to live in an institution? Wedlock is worse than padlock, it is deadlock. Before your father and I were married, he said, I will. On our wedding day, he said, I do, but he doesn't say anything anymore. The only glow in our marriage is that encouraging phrase, encouraging, till death do us part. Number three is drifting, or middlescence. That's when the broad mind and the narrow waist change places. Maggie and Ed Burke need to be warned that about 25% of all divorces occur at this crucial time, 15 years or so into the marriage. Our hypothetical couple, Maggie and Ed Burke, remain legally joined but have little respect, tolerance, or intimacy at the time in their lives when they need it most. Daughter Florence is leaving home for marriage. Son Fred is leaving home for a career. The grandparents' failing health is causing worry. Egbert is at the pinnacle of his career, and yet Maggie and Egbert are strangers to each other, just drifting. And number four is driving. Go or grow. From here it is but a short drive between drifting apart and dropping out. Maggie and Egbert feel that time and energy and opportunities are running out. They face the temptation of being driven to depression, alcohol or other addiction, workaholism, adultery, or psychosomatic illness. Maggie and Egbert's gloomy picture is not what must inevitably be. It is but a somber indicator of the seriousness of communication in courtship and in marriage. Shakespeare said that marriages are made in heaven, but he failed to add that marriage comes in a kit-set form which needs to be worked at by both partners. The same is true for courting, and indeed for all interpersonal relationships. Now let's look at this relationship kit set. Once again, we have several points to consider. Number one, guidance. There is only one foundation for all home life, church life, school life, work life, national life, and that is Jesus Christ. From the tiniest atom to the mightiest galaxy, from the affairs of the universe to the prayers of his children, we can trust him as much as we need him as our guide in every decision of our life. Without his guidance, we make impossible demands. In fact, there are three basic urges of the ego which make unreasonable claims on one's courtship or marriage partner. These demands are, number one, to be loved unconditionally. Only God can do this. For us, this is an impossible expectation. Even if my companion expressed true love all of the time, there will be occasions when I will misunderstand or misinterpret some words and actions. Number two, the impossible demand to have all my needs met. Again, this is foolishness. How can any one person completely understand, let alone fulfill, another person's every single emotional, spiritual, social, intellectual, and physical desire? Can't be done. And the third impossible demand would be to change others so that I might have the security and purpose in life that I desire. Let's look back at Maggie and Egbert's wedding day. To say that Maggie was nervous would be like calling Mount Everest tall. She was especially terrified that she'd mess up her grand entry. Her dad reassured her with these words. He said, "As you walk arm in arm with me down the aisle, keep your eye on the altar and listen for the hymn. Just remember these three things, the aisle, the altar, and the hymn." And so Maggie was heard to whisper reassurance to herself for the length of the church, those three words, aisle, altar, hymn, aisle, altar, hymn, aisle, altar, hymn. People are changed. Changed, but not by external force. We may make cosmetic changes to make life easier, but generally we become resentful of change unless from within. God offers some alternatives to these natural yet unreasonable demands. Let's just look at those three demands again and see how we can change unreasonable demands into inspired resolves. And number one, to be loved unconditionally becomes, I will give unconditional love. See the difference? Number two, to have all my needs met becomes, I will aim to meet the other's needs. Number three, to change others becomes, by the grace of God, I will change myself. This is an attitude of making a difference rather than expecting a difference. An attitude of doing rather than demanding. To understand how to achieve this attitude, let us remember that Jesus instituted a new commandment to expand out the old commandment to love thy neighbour as thyself. He said, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you." Through Jude, he said, "Keep yourselves in the love of God." These two things, keeping God's love and loving each other as Christ loves, are what makes it all possible. Interpersonal relationships can only be complete as triodes, the heavenly family consisting of three persons in harmony with each other. And if we wish to be in harmony with anyone, fiancé, spouse, children, friend, we must include Christ into the relationship as a vital component. Okay, we were looking at the kit set marriage. Guidance, number one. Number two, governing. When you allow Christ into the relationship as a vital component, you will not attempt to be a perfectionist. A sure recipe for heartache, heart attack, ulcers, is to attempt to be perfect in every sphere of life. Growing in your relationship with others cannot take place if you are already perfect. Perfection is the ultimate reward for a lifetime of growth, not to take the place of growth here and now. And the next one is giving. Recapping what I said earlier about Maggie clicking away with her knitting while Egbert was absorbed in his reading. The silence, you may recall, I described as being ungolden. One was thinking, "I love you so much I don't need to talk," and the other was thinking, "You must be angry with me or you would talk with me." Remember? 50% of troubled marriages are the silent husband. Marriages and courtships can develop healthfully if each of you make the time to talk. Maggie suggests, "Why don't you talk to me while I knit?" And Egbert replies, "Why don't you knit to me while I read?" The other major factor in troubled marriages is the presuming wife. This is when Maggie presumes that Egbert has extrasensory perception to read her variable emotional states and thus respond to her needs. Egbert inquires, "You're very quiet this evening, dear. Is there anything wrong?" Evasively, Maggie replies, No, I'm just a little tired, that's all." Egbert tries again. "Something is bothering you, isn't it?" "You know what it is, all right," she yells. "Just a word of warning, Egbert. If you even dare to admit that you don't know, out will flow a torrent of coupons she's been collecting in her purse of her mind for weeks." Actually, both kinds of communication are to blame. Marital and courtship silence is like a stagnant pool, breeding suspicion which needs to be rippled to destroy the larvae of doubt. "Speak the truth in love that you may grow." Ephesians 4:15. It says in part, "Speaking the truth in love that you may grow." Take time to talk in love without threats. Someone once said, "The grave of marriage is excavated by a series of little digs." The only difference between a rut and a grave is the depth. It's my observation that criticism is almost always felt to be destructive by the hearer. And number four is growing. Growing in any relationship involves learning by listening. God, in his wisdom, gave us two ears for active listening, two eyes for sharing a tear, two shoulders for comforting, two arms for loving, but only one mouth. Talking cannot of itself resolve any issue. Now, there's a world of difference between hearing and listening. If you only hear your partner, you don't listen. Instead of dialogue in two-part harmony, all you have is monologue in two-part cacophony. So, what's the difference then between hearing and listening? Well, let's go through the list. Hearing is passive. Listening is interactive. Hearing is static. Listening is dynamic. Hearing is face to place. Listening is person to person. Hearing is speech to screen. Listening is soul to soul. Hearing is a meeting of words. Listening is a meeting of persons. Hearing receives words, but listening receives the meaning of the words. Hearing receives the medium, and listening receives the message. Hearing creates the initiative for listening to be industrious. Hearing is undisciplined reception, but listening is disciplined understanding. James 1:19 says, "Take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry." Egbert, you need to know that men tend to speak with facts, whereas most women speak with feelings. Maggie and Egbert are a church social. If somebody asked Egbert where his daughter's dress came from, he would oblige by naming the department store or boutique. If Maggie was asked where her daughter's dress came from, she'd probably reply, "Why? What's wrong with it?" Men tend to externalize and women tend to internalize. Warning, Egbert, again, warning. If you merely reply to the words your distraught wife is saying, you will be in difficulty. "But that's what you said, dear," he sighs helplessly. "I know," Maggie replies, "but it's not what I meant." She may be saying, "Go away and leave me alone," when what she is really saying is, "Hold me close and tell me you love me." There are two hindrances to listening that ought to receive special mention. One is a problem common with men, and the other is a problem common with women. The problem common with men is the hindrance of preoccupation. Egbert, it seems, can watch one sports match on television while listening to another on the radio and tell you precisely the state of play of both games despite interruptions from the children. Fred, Florence, telephone, all these things. However, when Maggie chats casually, he often doesn't take in what she says. Warning, warning. Egbert, you must pay attention, or you will pay the cost. What Egbert calls trivia, Maggie calls meaningful. It's important to her. So the hindrance to listening that is common to men is the hindrance of preoccupation. Now the hindrance of listening that is common to women is the hindrance of prejudice. Likewise, when Maggie is emotionally worked up over an issue, she may not register what is being said. Maggie was anxious when Egbert formulated a set of rules regarding the children's dating, homework and curfew hours. When he set to spell out these to 16-year-old Florence, Maggie, who was listening from the next room, was convinced he'd blown it, and was astounded when Florence was able to accept and repeat the rules because she had accepted them in love. Prejudice caused Maggie to put her own interpretation in what she'd heard. Proponents of listening theory recommend what they call reflective listening. This is gaining feedback by clarifying what was said through repetition or questioning. For example, Maggie could ask, "Do I understand you correctly? Do you mean," etc., etc. Maggie's most infamous misinterpretation took place when Egbert overheard her chatting to herself while she opened one of her Christmas presents one year. Inside was a skunk fur coat. In wonder she exclaimed, "I can't believe such a lovely coat could come from such a stinking animal." Whereupon from the other room Egbert's voice was heard to boom out, "I don't ask for thanks, but I do expect a little respect." Number 5 in our Kitset marriage is grace. Ephesians 4:29 reads, "Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers." How can we administer grace to those who listen? Well, here's a few suggestions. Number 1, be an encourager. These things speak for themselves, don't they? Number 2, reinforce your partner's strong points. Number 3, ask for his or her views and opinions. Number 4, make allowances for mistakes and deficiencies. Number 5, give the opportunity for him or her to develop his or her gifts. And number 6, respect secrets. Don't demand to know every detail. His or her holding back bad news may be to spare you distress. Okay, as we draw today's seminar to a close, if those ushers would like to gather in the question slips, we'll either discuss them now, or if a more detailed answer is appropriate, they'll be discussed in our next program. So it's question time now. Do we have any questions from the floor before we read the written questions that we have listed?